Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. All About Art, with Daisy Wilson and Jack Sidal.
Hello and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. Today we have another of our episodes that looks at a particular discipline within mainstream education. And today we're looking at art and design. And we're playing with the format a little bit this time. We've got two guests who are going to be joining us to have a little look at art and design in education. The first is an ITE practitioner, Daisy Wilson, who works in the University of Wales Trinity St David. And the second is, you know, a brand spanking new art teacher, fresh from our PGC Secondary Art and Design programme here at Cardiff Met. His name is Jack Sidal, and he's going to be talking to us about an assignment that he did inquiring into his discipline in mainstream education.
Yes, so we should hopefully get some interesting perspectives from those two very different sources. First of all, we discussed with Daisy what she felt the nature of the subject was. So let's have a listen to what Daisy had to say to us.
What is art as a classroom subject? Like, what is it about art? What does it give to young people? You know, if a head teacher were coming to you and saying, actually, Daisy, we don't really need art in the curriculum, what would be your rebuttal?
My goodness, where to start? That's a big one. And, you know, I've had a big sort of shift in my thinking surrounding this over, well, since COVID, really. I was always very, very standards driven. And it was always, I suppose, you know, as a secondary school teacher, you've always got at the end, you've got those GCSEs, you've got those A-levels, and you're working towards those. And so it was very much, it felt, because of time, that you were choosing one, it's skills, or we're going for the love of the subject and the creativity. And interestingly, in different schools I've worked in, that's been different. So in my more recent school, very academic type school, it was far more about the skills. When I worked in a school up in the Rhondda, it was about expression and about autonomy, and so there were slight differences depending on the school I was in. And although we were still working towards those GCSE results, the route to get to them was sort of different. But what is it? Sorry, go back to the question. Art, it's about expressing yourself, and I suppose whereby I thought it was about the skills, I thought the expression and the well-being impact was a sort of a byproduct of making those great bits of artwork. Whereas now I had a real shift since COVID to the importance of art as a subject for positive well-being, as well as needing to have really good skills. So it's always finding that balance between the two.
One of the things I've noticed we've got in common, music and art, two subjects you might think are quite different. I remember we had our student teachers in not so very long ago from the three art subjects chatting away about their work, trying to make sense of curriculum for Wales and the areas of learning and experience. And certainly, a bit like you, music in the curriculum has always been conceived as a practical subject, and you learn it by doing it. You know, you make music, you listen to music, you compose music, you perform it. It's never been, certainly in the curriculum in Wales, never been set up as a sort of music appreciation type thing or a music theory type thing. And similarly, I guess with art, it's not just a sort of art appreciation subject. It's a doing with appreciating it as a holistic part of it. The thing that I noticed in common was that when we got our students in, the non-art students were all very, very happy to say, oh, I can't draw to save my life. I can't do art to save my life. And I remember the art student was bristling a little bit in the same way as we music people do, because you will always find people who are very happy to say, oh, I'm tone deaf. I can't do music. I can't, you know, and it makes you think, oh gosh, you know, something's happened there in your life that has made you believe that this subject is just a closed shop to you. So where does that come from in the art world? Is that something that goes on in the way that they have been taught the subject, where they've been made to believe that it's not for them? Is it something about the values that have come from the teacher? Why do we have that thing in common as our two subjects?
Yeah, the thing of the I can't do
I
art.
Can't.
I'm no
I
good.
I can't
and,
draw. Yeah.
And I was talking to Emma about that just before. It's one of the most frustrating sort of things because, you know, Year 7's notorious for saying, I can't draw. And no, art's not for me. And older generations say, oh, I can only draw a stick man and that's it, you know. And yeah. You're like, oh, goodness. Well, you haven't met someone who has taught you in the right way then, have you? Because, you know, drawing, maybe that stick man's actually a great stick man in the context that it's required. But it's understanding that difference between the skills and the love of the subject, isn't it? And is a visual language. And when I get students or children who say that to me, my instinct is, okay, we just need to look at this in a different way. Whereas in actual fact, what I was saying to Emma is sometimes I'd have children who come in at year 7 and they were the best artists, and everybody knew in that class that they're the best artist. And that's because perhaps, and this is no judgment on the teachers that they'd had in primary school, but they had learned to draw something step by step. More and more things like YouTube or Pinterest is just a nightmare, really. But step by step. And they were good at following those instructions, and therefore children perceived that they were the best artists. I often get people saying to me, is that a good painting? Shall I buy it? Shall I buy that print? And I always say, well, what do you think? How does it make you feel? Would you like to have it on your wall? You know, and I've had these conversations with children, and they say, yeah, you know, it makes me feel like this, I like that colour. And I say, well, that's great, you know, and if that's something you buy from IKEA that's mass produced and you like it on your wall, it makes you feel happy, great. If you want me to talk to you about visual language and about composition and whether that is technically a good piece of work, and I can break it down using that visual language, but I think that's quite a difficult thing for a non-specialist to understand, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of subjects in school where you do comfortably have right and wrong, don't you?
Yes.
And actually for the pupils, it's kind of comfortable to know if they're right or wrong. I remember pupils used to call me over to listen to their compositions and say, you know, is this right, sir? And I'd be kind of like, what? And I suppose, you know, we're going to talk about non-specialists in a little bit, but as specialists, if we just think about those of us who are kind of in the happy position of being trained in the subject that we're actually teaching, the way that we've been trained sometimes might come from a place where we've got into a quite elitist place,
yes,
where
absolutely.
Technique and execution is prioritised above all things. And I know this is something, you know, Emma and I talk about what we bang on about all the time. This is the thing I bang on about music, is that we might have come through that very elite training, but we have to be very careful that those values don't rub off a little bit on the pupils, particularly in a school environment where there is quite a lot of it's right or it's wrong, or you've got an E or a B or a 25 out of 30 or whatever, and we have to watch that.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I'm obsessive about drawing, always have been, and I'm from North Wales originally. I went to Edinburgh College of Art primarily because it did drawing and painting as a specialist area, whereas other universities were more inclined to do fine art. And it was because I felt drawing was so important. And that has stuck with me. And I've had to really change my thinking surrounding that. Because actually, as somebody that drawing was an obsession, it was actually very difficult to teach. Because there are, if you're teaching analytical drawing, in Edinburgh I used to do anatomical drawing, so you know it is all about right and wrong muscles and so on. It was difficult at first for me to teach that. I've made it a point of being able to teach that to a fairly high standard now, by breaking it down and making it simple, because I think there are some children that do want to be able to draw in a way that is right and wrong. And I think as a teacher, it can't all be about expression and mark making. And sometimes we want to do something that's a really good analytical drawing. And I need to be able to teach how to do that as an art teacher, as well as give the other experiences.
And I guess it sort of hits on another issue within our
art forms is that they are so broad. And it's one of the things that makes them so great is that there's a real breadth in terms of style and form yes. and expression and, the, you know, and sometimes it, your love of the subject comes from having a load of broad experiences and going, oh, that's for me. Yes. I mean, an example I might give is that, you know, I might have some male pupils who have absolutely hated the subject until they come to do stage combat. Yep. I'm being very gender stereotypical there, yep. but, you know, something that makes the discipline resonate with you. Mm. And I wonder if the another challenge at primary is that if you're not a specialist or if you feel that a barrier is that you don't have the skills yourself, when actually, in fact, there are certain parts of drama as a discipline that I do not have the skills to teach, but I wouldn't avoid teaching them because I know I've got all the other foundational knowledge. But I wonder if we, you know, in the primary phase, you might just tactically reduce it down to the thing that you feel you can comfortably teach.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's why then when pupils come to year seven, they go, art is this. They think
yes, of course.
Your discipline is that particular version of or style of.
Oh, absolutely. I think primary school teachers have such a difficult task on their hands. Mm. And why wouldn't you go with what you're comfortable with? I understand. I can understand exactly where it comes from. Mm. But equally, I think it's something that needs to be supported. And we need to work far more closely, you know, secondary and primary sort of specialists. And I don't think that there are opportunities to do that, and that is problematic.
Well, this is an important question, isn't it? Because we are in the climate of, you know, curriculum reform. We've got curriculum for Wales, which on paper looks great.
Wonderful.
For the arts. You know, yeah. We have our own area of learning and experience, and we have a place at the table if we haven't previously. And this, you know, this offer to all of us to get together, to collaborate, to give pupils a more seamless experience of art subject yes. from primary to secondary. However, in practice, as you've just said, there's an issue. Do you feel, maybe a bit of a controversial question, but do you feel that what we have in the curriculum for Wales, in that, you know, the published version that we have, is enough for non-specialists?
No.
And if not, what do you think they need? We often ask this, Tom, don't we? If you could pull any particular lever that might address that gap, what would it be?
I guess it's time and time to work with specialists and work with them. So I know that there are, and I won't name specifically, but there are opportunities where you have specialists who go in and work with schools. But I think it's how you work with primary school teachers and develop their confidence without giving them a huge extra workload. I think we need to be really careful that you don't have specialists of certain subjects who go in and they do a huge, exciting project and we tick that off. Oh, yeah, we've done expressive. Oh, that's brilliant. That's it. We tick that off for this year. And the teachers are no better off. Their confidence and their ability to deliver those subjects themselves hasn't developed.
If anything, it's probably gone down if
absolutely.
They've seen that specialist.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's really, I think that's a really worrying model, which is, and I think there are also people, you know, cashing in on it, people who are not necessarily trained visual artists or, you know, expressive creative people who are offering services to school without knowledge of that curriculum. And again, we have tick box exercises. We go into a school, we do a lovely mural and we tick that off and off we go. We go up to the next school and we do another mural that looks fairly similar. But, you know, so I think there just needs to be a relationship, an ongoing relationship between primary, secondary school teachers, I think. So it's embedded. It's not about doing a big fancy project. It's about embedding small changes, things that are manageable in the day-to-day structure of a primary school setting that builds confidence in children and in the teachers. I think that would be my sort of approach. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, let's give some goodies and not charge for them, shall we, to all of these people struggling with this. Yeah. We won't cash in. We'll give out some goodies. As we've hinted now, there's a number of people who are being called upon to teach these subjects. You know, we're talking about art today particularly, who may not be confident, may not feel that they're trained, may not feel they can do it. And all three of us sitting around here are from those subjects. So if we think about art, you know, we might have, for example, a secondary school that's doing an expressive arts kind of mashup-y thing, where maybe the drama teacher's teaching art or the music teacher's teaching art as part of what they do. Mm. You might have, you know, we might have primary teachers who are terrified of doing art because they haven't done it since they were 13 and they got a couple of hours on their PGCE and that was it. So just to kind of demystify it or de-sort of scare it, but also protect the subject, what's the absolute sort of bottom line of we're doing art versus we're not doing art? So, you know, Emma's example for drama is always, you know, if the English department starts wanting to do some dramary stuff, brilliant. But if they're not getting up and actually practically doing that text, that play text, then it's not going to be drama. For me, you know, it's lovely if we're going to start putting, some music with some drama. You know, we're going to make a film. But if it's just sound effects, it's not music. Okay. It's not music. So there's a line where the subject gets, you know, we're all mashing up together or we're teaching it or we're going to be brave and we're going to teach that subject. And then there's a line beyond which it stops being that subject. Mm. What would be your absolute sort of red line, man the barricade thing? If you're not doing that, you're not doing art.
Oh, gosh. If you're not allowing for autonomy, I guess. For me, it's got to be that creativity. It's not making a poster using this media on a bit of A4 printing paper, you know. It's about having, being able to give their own, I suppose it's developing their own responses to things, not being, having too much constraints. Mm. It shouldn't be constrained. And I suppose that is the difficulty.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's got me thinking when Tom was saying that as well. You know, we've got our own examples of, you know, where the subject gets combined and it sort of gets diminished. Does that happen with art? Do you see that happening where art is being used in other subject disciplines and you go, oh, no. No, please don't do that.
Yes, but I will be honest, there is a snobbiness from my side. There has been in the past, and I can think of this one example where in a subject they had a student of ours who was a fantastic painter, actually, but she was involved in something, I can't remember what subject it was, but she was making a piece of artwork to raise awareness about mental health. And in actual fact, at that time, I was looking at what she was doing in the art room, which was actually really highbrow stuff for an A-level student. It was, and she was then making this piece of this painting, which was actually really expressive. It was her making decisions. And I was a little bit snobby. I think the art teachers at the time, we were a little bit snobby about that. And I said, oh, that's not particularly good. That's not. But actually, she was far more expressive in that piece of work. And actually what we had done, I feel embarrassed to say, was spoon fed her to get to this wonderful A-star quality, to get that grade that she was chasing. But actually what she was doing in another subject was actually, she was given a lot more freedom because there wasn't that constraint at the end. So I suppose, yes, I have been, and I still am. You know, I talk with my husband, and that's at primary school level. I am, but then I'm sort of always aware that I need not to be judgmental. And I think throughout my career, I have been. And that's something I feel I've changed in the last 5-6 years.
That's interesting, isn't it? There's something, we've got a bit of a hunch, Tom and I, that there is something about getting people, teachers, out of their place of work, their context that they know really well. You know, I'm just reflecting on you at the start of this podcast saying that you taught in two very different schools where the curriculum and the values and beliefs around that subject were quite different.
Very different.
And therefore the pupil's experience of the subject was different in those two locations. And so I'm also thinking about what you mentioned about, you know, primary schools and secondary schools working together. But then I also wonder, unless we get everybody out of that bubble and going, right, okay, but what can art be? And you know, what different ways are there of teaching the subject? And you know, why does art look like that in my context? And why do I teach it that way? I wonder if it's only then that, you know, this that feeling that you just expressed there of, you know, I don't want to judge people about, because, and of course, we don't. You are doing what you think is right for your pupils in that context. And actually, Curriculum for Wales mandates that you do that, that you make it locally relevant. But I wonder if what's missing and what would be really beneficial is just being able to get together outside of those contexts. And if you, and you're in the sort of privileged position that we are, where we get to pull the student teachers back out of school. I wonder, you know, what sort of conversations are they having about what art is and what it could be and their frustrations and all of that?
Yes, it's interesting to have, isn't it? And the different contexts that they are working in as well. You know, like I said, you know, that one school in my most recent teaching experience was very much grades driven, and I know how to teach to get those grades. But the time when I felt like I was the best teacher in my career was when I was working up in Tonopandy, and I didn't compromise those skills. Drawing, it was something initially there was a lot of pushback from the students because they hadn't done a lot of that kind of thing. But once the relationships were built, they were so creative, and I had to approach art far more creatively than in another school. But I also brought in the skills that I felt were integral to the subject. But I look back now, and those are the children who stayed in touch with me, who have gone off to be graphic designers in London, interior, really successful people with photography businesses. One girl I remember who would she just wanted to draw, and and she's an award-winning tattooist now, you know. So we have to think about the context that we're in, but also obviously we've still got that GCSEs and those A-levels at the end, haven't we? So I'm not sure I answered the question there, Emma. Sorry, no. I went off on one completely.
So we've heard from Daisy Wilson, who has given us some insight into art and design as a mainstream subject. And now we're going to turn to the work of Jack Siddall, who came in to talk to us about an inquiry that he did very close to practice when he was on one of his two placements here at Cardiff Met, dealing with a very hot topic within education, diversifying and decolonising the curriculum. And he is going to talk to us a little bit about how he designed that inquiry, what he was hoping to find out. And we get a better sense, I suppose, in this part of the episode about, in practice, how art and design teachers are making curriculum decisions, making pedagogical decisions within a particular context.
So given a complete free choice of topic for your assignment, for your inquiry assignment in your second placement, what was it you actually zeroed in on once you got yourself into school?
So obviously with assignment two, it can be quite a broad thing because it's an inquiry process. But what I chose to focus on was diversifying and decolonizing the curriculum within secondary art. And that is like the basically building the idea that it's like the importance and responsibility of being an anti-racist curriculum designer. So that's the title. But I guess what that actually really meant to me was looking at curriculum building in a way that we can try and make it, what's the way I would describe it? I guess it's like looking at trying to design a curriculum in a way that is fitting with the Welsh government's anti-racist policy. And obviously with the new Welsh curriculum, we are now curriculum designers as well. And there's a lot of responsibilities in there that probably previously wouldn't have fell on teachers to deliver on this level. So, yeah.
And I guess there were a number of important steps that you took. Before we come to sort of, you know, the literature that guided this, it probably makes more sense, it's probably more authentic for you to tell us, you know, what were you noticing, without mentioning the name of the school, what were you noticing in school that sort of made it clear to you that actually that you needed to make some kind of intervention or change to your practice to help this?
This was a natural decision to lead in this direction. So when I first arrived at the school, it's a school in Cardiff. It is a school in Cardiff. It's a city, you know, it's a city school, and it's one that is, it's got very high rates of poverty. We've got like over half the school is eligible for free school meals. There is a lot of challenges there. It's a super diverse school as well, but it is a school that is very much like got a whole range of staff who want to try and make the best out of what they've got in every sense of that meaning, you know. But one thing that really stood out to me when I first looked through the curriculum in my first week there, I was looking at their sort of curriculum pathway. I was looking and flicking through all the books just to try and see what kind of work they'd done previously, because I just felt like that's something that really makes sense when you turn up somewhere new. You want to know what, you know, what they expect, also what they've done before, so you can maybe bring something original or support something that already exists there. But it just became really, really stand out to me straight away that there wasn't a single artist that was from, you know, that was from as a POC. There wasn't a single female artist. Like every single artist that was currently within the Key Stage 3 curriculum was a white man, and more often than not, a dead white man. And it's like very like cliche, but it was like that. It just seemed a little bit outdated for where we're at now.
I'm laughing, Jack, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there was even a quote from a pupil in your assignment about who we're going to study next. I think you quoted the pupil and they said, as long as they're not dead.
Yeah, genuinely. And it's like, and I think because my mentor was super on board with this, they were constantly taking little moments and notes of things that happened like that, even things that I didn't necessarily see around the room, because obviously when you're teaching, you're doing a million and one things. You know, you've got like 33 students in a year 9 class, you're not going to pick up on everything. But yeah, I think the kids are far more aware of this than we realise, and they are looking for something that resembles what it's like to live now. You know, it is important to focus on these, you know, these pillar stones, these like huge important artists as well. And they do provide a really big context to how we view art in this big sort of scale. But it doesn't really fit into a lot of students' lives. It doesn't make a lot of sense how art fits into their sort of worldview, I guess. Yeah.
And you did something just to finish off this bit about, you know, what did you do to confirm what you needed to do? You looked at the art portfolios at Key Stage 4, I think, Key Stage 5, and because you didn't want to make any assumptions.
No,
did
I didn't
you?
Want to make any assumptions. So obviously at Key Stage 4 and 5, there was a lot more like student, it's going to be a lot more student led. And then that's when I started to notice that there was more diversity within the range of artists there. And I think that is something that probably tends to happen quite a lot in the creative subjects. Once it's led by students, they start to select things that actually maybe resemble their own interests and are outside of, I guess, what we sometimes think is important. You know, sometimes you can look at students' work from Key Stage 4 and 5 and you're like, why are they going in this direction? And it can sort of, you know, as an educator, it can make you panic a bit. But as long as there's some relevance to it, then you can support that and maybe even guide them in different directions as well. But I definitely think this led me to think that Key Stage 3 plays a really big role in actually the new Welsh curriculum as well. Like if we think about citizen building, there's actually the biggest scope for that in Key Stage 3. And by the time we get to Key Stage 4 and 5, unfortunately, we do start to feel the pressure of what it's like to deliver high quality results in GCSE and A-level. So it almost means that is the best space to explore, really. And with discussions with my mentor, who was super supportive and was like, we need this update, and thinking about different things we could do, they were super on board for me to design some curriculum with this in mind and something that reflected the demographic of the school and thinking about how it can engage the community of the school as well. Yeah.
I think that's a point that's worth picking up on actually before we sort of dive into the detail of the inquiry that you did, is that it's quite potentially a tricky situation to find yourself in. You're being asked to do an inquiry, potentially to make a change to your practice that is going to kind of affect what goes on in your department. You're quite a transient visitor to that school and that department. You're there for about 4 months.
you're also trying to pass the programme in that department. And so you're not in a kind of really clean cut and easy situation when you're doing that. And for me, I mean, I was marking this work when it came in. It really jumped out at me that you could, particularly on this topic, have gone in as like a massive social justice warrior and put everybody's backs up. And that could have actually ended incredibly badly. And so it was just really interesting to me that you did navigate that difficult thing well. And obviously, hats off to your department, because they could have not been very pleased, but they were on board as well.
Yeah, I think the really key thing is that, as obviously the term social justice warrior, it carries quite a lot of baggage these days, you know. It almost implies that, you know, it's very much tied into the idea of like cancel culture. It's tied into these other bigger sort of topics, which actually I think sort of create this sense of like anxiety about not wanting to do something wrong. And that doesn't necessarily mean there's like space for reflection. And I've always kind of come from this place where I felt like we need to be able to actually just prepare to like look at ourselves, think about what is or isn't working, and not necessarily punish ourselves. A lot of the structures of racism or colonization, they're huge. They're gonna be quite passive, and you could, as I mean, anyone from any background, like, could genuinely be supporting outdated narratives, and you can just erase things by not mentioning things and not making them part of the curriculum as well. So it wasn't a process of shaming. You know, I wasn't out here like, I'm going to get, you know, try and rally something up on Twitter around you. I think that's it. I think it's very unfortunate that social justice warrior timeline coincided with a point in time on the internet where everyone just sort of jumped on someone on Twitter and, you know, tried to turn it into a very big, you know, hyped up, high engagement thing. Whereas really, in many ways, the best place to have these conversations are in more like face to face and, you know, keeping the human involved in it. And we can try and think about, you know, like, how has this come about? Maybe it's just because all the teachers are really struggling for time and that they're just sort of adapting things that were made a long time ago, you know, and could just do a bit of an update as well. So yeah, I think it was just really productive conversations, I think. And most people can tell, you know, they know what they're teaching and they know it needs areas that could be updated in as well. Yeah.
Another challenge of this assignment is that, you know, this is a master's level assignment. So you had to do some reading and engage with sort of theoretical, intellectual, she says in air quotation marks, knowledge. But you are also tasked with, and I think this is something that made your work incredibly powerful and authentic, is you also need to have an understanding of the knowledge of your learners, the knowledge of the context, the knowledge of the school, this particular sort of subject-specific knowledges that, and you sort of have to synthesize all of that in order to decide what you're going to do in practice. So perhaps you could just give us a bit of a flavor. Like, what was the literature telling you? What did you come to know about the kids? And how did that in turn then guide you in what you were going to do?
I would say almost before I even got to that point would be that, I think because I came from like a humanities background anyway, I previously studied international relations and then I've worked in the arts my whole life, and that was like a sort of little hiatus, I guess, and then came back to it again. I've always had this kind of mindset where I've been able to sort of like apply lenses to things and think about viewing things through a lens. And I think very much the opportunity this year to be educated in the new Welsh curriculum and think about almost having a lens for it, I could actually approach it with that in mind, you know? And that isn't necessarily easy because there's a lot of big barriers to actually implementing that. But the first thing was more just thinking about, I always think about this, what is like an authentic learning context for anything? I think when we look at the new Welsh curriculum, I try and think about it more as like starting from the big ideas down to the small ideas, you know? It's not about thinking, oh, I want to use this artist, and now I have to find a way to make it make sense with one of the four purposes. It should almost be like, know your learners, observe, start to think about how that fits into a bigger citizen building mentality, because it is ultimately, education is quite a political project. It is, you know, we're like, we are in many ways like civil servants. In some countries, teachers even are. But we are trying to implement policy. So I guess what I did initially was just trying to get to know the school and get to know what was going on there. I think what was really clear to me straight away was from having conversations was, one, we knew that the students in the area weren't really exploring the city. They didn't access the city in the same way that a lot of people would around Cardiff. They didn't know much about Cardiff. In my year nine class, for example, we had a quite high proportion of students because of their faith. They're from one particular sect of Islam. They did not draw any living things. They didn't draw any faces. And so that instantly created a lot of barriers around maybe them accessing things like portraiture. And those were two quite clear points for me of like thinking about more like lesson building. But to then build it, to bring it back more into the research, it was just more about what is actually going on with art and design education right now, you know, trying to understand what are the key issues there. We know more and more that within the arts and within our specialty that we're being asked to do more with less continuously. And all of the literature that I found was really, you know, it was really clear that there is a sort of looming arts crisis there, and it's starting to become somewhat of an afterthought in some capacity. And that doesn't necessarily mirror the real working world. We know that arts is in the UK is actually some of its strongest position it's been in a long time. So yeah, it was interesting to me to think about that, but also just sort of to consider what the pupils were like in that school as well. But the main thing was thinking about on the backdrop of this new era this sort of new era where we find ourselves in with a new curriculum and also building towards this anti-racist Wales. It's like, how can we do that in our own curriculums? How can we do that as an individual teacher to support that as well?
Something that struck me in your lit review actually as well about the nature of art and design at the moment is this whole shift towards the sort of, how did you put it, like bedroom artists? Like
yeah, I think that's a good point actually. That was something that I was thinking about with like authentic contexts here in particular. It's like, what does an artist look like in 2025? You know, if we think about art as existing solely within gallery spaces, then that's quite an antiquated view. In reality, an artist now is many things, you know, whether that's a visual artist or a musician or whatever, you're your own publicist. You're going to be networking yourself. You're going to be your own, you know, brand as well. It's changed, you know, and I think rather than trying to encourage my students to be, you know, the next David Hockney, which I would love for them to be, that's an unbelievably unrealistic expectation to have on a student. I think what's more advisable would to be look at like something that actually seems somewhat achievable. A lot of people now, most working artists that I've come across or know personally or don't know at all, are genuinely working out of their own bedrooms. This is something, you know, done via social media. They have their own, like, they have their own websites where they'll sell their prints or they'll sell their artwork or they'll engage in like brand collaborations as well. And it's just as authentic to have someone come in who's got, you know, 10,000 followers and talk about how they practice as an artist than just, you know, going and seeing one of the greats. It's still, if anything, it probably makes it seem more achievable and more realistic and something that can be done for these students, you know, as well.
I feel like we're sitting on the brink of a really interesting discussion at some point in Wales about subject specialism, because for whatever reason, you know, we've seen some issues around subject specialism, whether it is that there have been some misconceptions around the curriculum framework or, you know, some schools don't have the luxury of having any subject specialists in certain subjects because of the recruitment crisis, whatever it may be. I think the thing that really jumped out at me was the way, I mean, obviously you can go and you can get to know your pupils and you can do some reading and you can speak to your department. But then as a subject specialist, and I know obviously you said you studied international relations, but you've been in the arts, you are an art specialist. You were then able to select the artists that you felt those pupils needed. And you came up with some really, really interesting choices that were such a good fit for the pupils. Tell us about the artists that you actually came up with.
So, yeah, I think that's it is an interesting conversation thinking about whether this is the massive benefit of having a specialist, isn't it? You know, this is what is always going to be the advantage. And also, you can still be a specialist, but not necessarily be as minded about certain artists. You know, I guess another debate is about whether everyone is a curriculum designer or not, you know, and how that looks. But for the artists that I chose, the first artist that I chose to work with my year seven cohort, which was virtually all of the school of year seven, I think I nearly taught every single class, was an artist called Stephen Wiltshire, who's quite famous for having having savant syndrome. So he's an autistic artist. He calls himself an autistic artist. He's also a Black British artist, but he doesn't actually specify as that. It's like he feels like for him, what's more important is, you know, his journey of autism and how art has also been a voice for him. He was nonverbal for a lot of his life, and then art was a means for him to communicate as well. So for him, he uses this insane talent that he has, which is he goes up in like helicopters and then draws these, like afterwards, from memory, draws these hyper detailed pen sketches of these landscapes. And I think what for me was screaming at me thinking about that artist was this idea that getting the students from this area to then treat Cardiff as this place that they could go and explore. So within that lesson, very much sort of built around other bits of research I looked at. I think there's one by like Diamo, and it's like this like art as a, what is the actual, let's see. I think it's like, I'll try and have a quick look. Sorry. Basically, so there's one piece of literature by Diamo, and it essentially tries to bring metacognition into the art classroom as much as possible. And essentially, I wanted to try and get as much collaboration around them trying to get to know their city that they live in. And we did this idea of like memory maps, and they all came together and drew on these big pieces of paper and tried to almost cross-pollinate and share knowledge and build a picture of Cardiff that they could all piece together. And I think it was actually really surprising for someone who grew up in Cardiff as well, how little knowledge outside of their like estate and area that they had. They just aren't going to the city. They're not using it in a way that is that is beneficial to them. There is so many aspects of why this is the case. You know, it's not like there's no blame put on them here. It's just completely poverty. At the end of the day, you know, poverty is always going to restrict the opportunities for any individuals in any capacity. And a lot of these kids just don't get the opportunities to actually leave where they live. And so I thought it'd be a good sort of avenue for them to have some artwork that sort of supports getting to know their city, but also with this sort of decolonial, diversified lens, it opened up loads of other avenues as well. We talked about neurodiversity within that lesson, and even it almost felt like you couldn't make it up, but I had some students over from the base in that lesson, and as soon as they found out that they were learning about an autistic artist, they genuinely high-fived themselves and gave themselves a high five. And it seems so simple, but just little bits of extra consideration do lead to so much more inclusivity. And I'm for sure, like, when that happened for those students, they suddenly felt like they were part of the classroom. You know, they weren't on the peripheries. And yeah, and then this also just sort of led to more engagement around Cardiff, and I'm sure for even some of them, just a sense of like belonging. I know we use Canevin quite loosely and we throw it around a lot, but I think that is how you connect people to your city, at least through art in that way. With my year nines, I mentioned this earlier about quite a few of the students weren't able to participate in a lot of the artwork. They were actually, you know, couldn't draw living things. So this is why I led towards pattern as my sort of avenue. And obviously within the Islamic world, pattern and art have a big relationship with one another. I think the wrong assumption at that point in time for me would have been like, I need to do a whole topic on Islamic art. You know, I think that would have had the potential to just alienate it and almost really spell it out very loudly what I'm doing. And I think the whole process of this, I was trying to do things sort of more passively, but just authentically and not being overt about what I was doing. You know, I didn't want it to seem insincere, and because that's when it does seem really insincere and it starts feeling like you're ticking boxes and it starts feeling like you are just doing it because of this pupil or whatever. It was more just trying to be as inclusive as possible. So we focused on two artists. One was Yayoi Kusama, which is one of the most, like, from Japan, who's like one of the most sort of well-known artists in the world right now. And then another was Yinka Olori, who's a British-Nigerian artist. And they both use pattern in lots of different ways, but Yinka Olori particularly focuses on this idea of like play and heritage. And I really tried to bring that into the classroom. And then we had this like collaborative like patchwork piece where they all came together at the end and they all debated about how it could come together. And even then, they're like, the amount of debates were, they were really, really mature. And I didn't expect that from my really large year nine class. But they even ended up resulting in like designing this pattern and putting one of the students' work in the middle, who was of Nigerian heritage. And because they felt like it made sense to also have a British Nigerian artist's work reflected in a British Nigerian student in the middle of this piece as well. And I honestly felt like, when I was writing this in the report, it's like, no one's going to believe that these changes are doing this. This seems like I'm actually faking it. But it was even for my mentor, they were just like, this is, you know, they were really, really like excited by this. And they were really, really, you know, I collaborated on a lot of this stuff with them. And it was really nice for them to observe it and be like, this is really making change. And I think that even for them, it was quite invigorating and, you know, nice to see that these kind of things can be done. Of course, time is always going to be the issue. But and luckily, in this moment in my educational journey, I do have some. So that's it, really.
This is the sort of inquiry project that it would sort of feel out of place and wrong to try and kind of quantify too mathematically what the outcomes were. You know, what sort of more qualitative, because you've given a hint at, you know, some of the qualitative things that occurred, the comments that the pupils made, the decisions that they made that were sort of facilitated by the changes to the curriculum that you made. Were there any sort of other sort of conclusions that you were able to draw from this about the, I hate the word, but the impact of what you did?
I think the success criteria was still really clear. Skills were completely embedded in this curriculum design. I think at the beginning, I always, with any project or anything, the lesson building, I tend to try and, you know, not apply too much pressure to the students straight away, particularly in our subjects. Confidence is everything. You know, I want them to feel comfortable to make mistakes, because mistakes is play, and play can lead to a lot, but play needs to be intentioned and it needs to be within a understanding of something already. And so there does need to be some context there, but I don't think you need to, you know, give them a 15-minute lecture on who this artist is straight away. That's not the way I'd approach it. It'd be more about modeling some kind of exercise that allowed them to play. For example, with the pattern lesson, just got big sheets of paper out, masking tape, lots of groups. We're like, okay, make as many patterns as possible, you know? And then we had a debate in the class about who had the most patterns, and we got the groups to come up and we'd be pointing things like, do we think that's a pattern? And so we'd be like, no, why is that not a pattern? And that then led to us thinking about how you create patterns. And then the outcomes really are the means to actually measure the success of the lessons. You know, they created pieces that actually, you know, they were obviously differentiated by outcome, but also they learned valuable skills in every single thing that they did. With year seven, I think within art, I think you can't get around the fact that sketching and drawing is just the backbone of everything. The more you do, the better you're going to have a grasp of a lot of stuff. But you don't want to exclusively do that. So there was a lot of modeling around that. And everything in that Stephen Wiltshire lesson I created was based around drawing, really. And you can do that in a very prescribed way, or you can do it more built into this idea of getting to know your city. And even for me, I was thinking about, it doesn't make sense to do painting with year seven straight away. Or, I mean, you can do it, you can. But particularly in the school I was in, I was like, I'd rather teach them how to draw with a pen, because they're likely to have that at home. Whereas if I start getting them to use clay and all these materials and they can't take that skill outside of the classroom, then it's almost a bit redundant. And with a lot of our subjects, you hone those skills outside of the classroom. You're not going to become the best artist in the world within an hour once a week. It's what you do outside of that. And so I felt like pen skills and drawing skills were essential with year seven. And the same with more like year nine, it was more like collage based and lots of, you know, thinking about pattern, but more design focused as well. And more examples about using an artist who is working today and collaborating with like fashion brands and things like that as well.
And just to sort of round it off, what's great there about what are the outcomes that you've expressed is that you don't have to sacrifice on the kind of subject-specific skills development, subject-specific, concepts when you're also trying to address something quite big, such as diversifying and decolonizing the curriculum. You know, you can marry the two together. So going forward, what have you learned about what it takes, what sort of steps it takes to start diversifying, decolonizing the curriculum in art and design?
I think the biggest thing is that as an educator, if you're not critically examining your own practice, you're going to be likely to sort of reinforce racist and classist power dynamics. And I think particularly in the literature in this assignment, I really focused on showing what decolonization is. It's this idea of trying to remove all these power structures that do exist and think about how you can dismantle them. And for me, this is something that I really think about very carefully. You know, it's every bit of information you receive as a student really, really defines how you view something. I think about this one art lesson I had in school, and it was all based around African masks. And that was my first time that I was exposed to African culture. And for a long period in my time, what did that teach me about African culture? It almost set it in a period of time like it was primitive, like it was tribal. And rather than considering that it's full of many nations, you know, it's full that are really different to one another with different levels of like development. And, you know, it really, so as much as it's great to think, oh, I want to do these African masks, they look amazing, without any sort of context in there, the construction of Africa within my mind as a student growing up was one of primitive, you know? And so I think it's like, these are all the questions you have to ask yourself. And it's just, the main thing is that we're constantly assessing what it is we're including, and that a diversity of voices and perspectives is always gonna lead to much better outcomes. And that if we constantly put forward what we think is important, we might be at danger of minimizing voices and ultimately engagement, you know, and that's it.
And that was Jack Siddall. And it's just really interesting to remind ourselves that Jack, as we're recording this, literally finished the PGC program this week. And that is a truly outstanding example of how you do inquiry in the classroom that has an impact and a strong subject specialism.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, what was coming through very, very clearly for me was the level of sort of, he talks about critical pedagogy in the assignment. And I think that level of criticality, you know, not just of the things that he was reading, but sort of the delicacy and diplomacy to which he was applying that criticality within the school context, you know, to his own perspective, you know, and the way that he made that land very clearly at the end about some of the traps that we can fall into as practitioners when it comes to these sort of really big, important sort of social and political agendas, I think is testimony to how outstanding that mind is. And I said to him as he left, I said, if you were to teach my children art and design, I would be a very happy person.
Yeah, I thought that subject specific angle was so relevant, because as we're putting this out, you sort of feel like there's a few kind of rumblings, or there's been a few comments and reports. And obviously we've got the Northern Ireland curriculum review. And I think just the way that, yeah, he can observe what's going on, he can speak to people, he can work out what kind of needs he wants to meet for his pupils. But then as a subject specialist to go and find those artists and be able to teach them so effectively, it just makes me think more and more there is just no substitute for that level of subject knowledge.
Well, you and I are sort of wedded to that idea, I guess. And, you know, I think hearing it from Jack and seeing it, you know, in black and white in his assignment has gone another step towards confirming it for me. So I think, you know, we've got to bear that in mind. And I guess, you know, we also can't ignore the fact that there are aspiring teachers out there who would and have, you know, have a real desire to teach outside of their discipline. But I think what we need to think carefully about as a nation is how we support them to do that well. And that has to be through the involvement of subject specialists, you know, that might include someone like Jack, who is a new teacher, but actually has an awful lot to give from a subject specialist perspective. And that's what I love about working with student teachers, is that often they'll pick up on things that sometimes haven't even occurred to me. You know, it's those sort of novice questions or sort of fresh new perspectives that can really drive the direction of travel in education.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's people out there in, you know, Curriculum for Wales land who would say that there never was any suggestion that subject specialism wasn't really important, but I think it always needs reinforcing. It's always a good time to reinforce that. So there we go. Lucky me, 23 assignments landed on me the other day, and that was one of them. So happy days. That's it for this episode about art and design. We hope you found it useful. There's something interesting in there for everybody, I think. We will be back with something else in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. The special guests this episode were Daisy Wilson from Urath Rover, Trinity St David Carmarthen, and Jack Siddall, an alumnus of our own PGC Secondary Art and Design course. Thank you to both of those for taking part. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lamburn, and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.